This is On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this first day of spring, Tuesday, March the 20th. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here to answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Some of the topics we'll be talking about today, we'll get some information and advice on financing a college education, another installment on our series on homeowners insurance. Are prepaid debit cards a good idea? Plus, we will have some information now on the 3-year anniversary of the stock market collapse as well. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and we have a rare treat. He joins us in our studios in Madison. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
How do you like this weather?
I don't like it. I love it.
I love it, too. And this is the first day of spring. Our last day of winter was, you know, another record-breaking warmth. And we'll probably see more records set today, high statewide in the 70s. It's going to really cool off, though, by the end of the week. I see down here in Madison, anyway, temperatures maybe in the mid-60s. So we'll have to our winter coats on.
Yeah, as long as we don't get 6 inches of snow on the 4th of July, I'm fine with all of this.
That's right. Well, it's pleasure to have you here. I know you and I have some On Your Money listener business to attend to later this evening. And we also wanted to observe the 3-year, I guess, anniversary of the stock market collapse. And I'm wondering, Kevin, 3 years later, with the economy improving some, is it time to celebrate?
Well, it could be, depending on your perspective. If you're looking backward or looking forward, the economy is definitely getting better, and it is a time that's still fresh in most investors' minds from just March of 2009. We had just gone through Lehman Brothers and the housing crisis. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a low of about 6,500 or so, and just recently crossed over the 13,000 mark. So that's about a 100% gain in the last 3 years. Now, that's still back to where it was several times back in the mid-2000s, but some people might be looking at the rising stock market and at the economy improving and say, ooh, maybe I'll get back in right now. But depending on what your situation is, this may be the worst time to get in, not the best time.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. How is the economy improving?
A better phrase might be it has improved. Housing is still very low, but it's not falling further, and it seems like prices have bottomed out. The question is how soon they will rise and how much, and the answer to that is probably not much and not for quite a while. The banks and financial institutions are in better shape. Many of them passed recent stress tests for better or for worse, and the European crisis has been averted for now, but if you are looking at all this so-called good news and saying, now I should put my money into the stock market again, keep in mind that good news usually comes at highs in the stock market, not at lows. Bad news comes at lows. Good news comes in at highs. And a lot of the growth that that we've seen in the economy and the job market and the housing market has been subsidized by artificial low interest rates, which have been a solution to the crisis and also a cause for new reasons to worry.
Why should we be worried about the low interest rates?
It's encouraged more speculation. I mean, first of all, you have the government issuing a lot of debt because it's very inexpensive to do that. And that's not just the United States government. Governments worldwide are issuing a ton of debt because interest rates are so low. And this cheap money encourages more speculation on other asset prices. One of the reasons that land prices and stocks and raw materials have risen is because people who run billions and trillions of dollars, when they can't get any kind of yield whatsoever on their safe money, they start looking for other assets to invest in, and that boosts the asset prices up as they search for more growth. And many individual investors are also searching for more return because they check the interest rates on safe money like CDs and treasuries and the I-bonds we've discussed, and they say, gosh, 1 or 2% just really isn't that great of a deal. So I'm going to stick my neck out here and try to get a higher rate of return, but you may be taking on too much risk in your search for reward.
So what advice do you have for investors? Do we get in or stay out?
Well, first of all, check your statements, the ones you received at the end of the year or the ones you are going to receive in a few weeks for the first quarter ending, and look at that dollar amount. And if it is in stock funds or you're thinking about putting in stock funds, take 30 to 40% of that off the top and say, could I handle it if that amount were to drop? And even bond funds could have a 10 to 20% loss if interest rates rise. Now, that would put prices back to where they were a couple years ago. If you can handle that, then, you know, stay on, especially if you're still contributing to it and you won't need it for college or for retirement or for a big purchase for quite a while. But otherwise, if you can't handle that kind of a drop, or you aren't contributing anymore and buying in as prices fall, or you might need the money within a year or two, at least rebalance and move the money out of the more aggressive stuff into the more conservative investments. And you may just want to take it out completely and just say, you know what, I'm satisfied just preserving what I have and not worrying about trying to make more off of it and exposing myself to more losses.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Kevin, a stepmother wants to know, if her husband's parents are contributing money to a 529 college savings plan for her husband's daughter, is there a way that her husband's ex-wife could use that money for something other than college expenses for the daughter? Sounds like we've got something else going on here, too.
Well, it sounds like this question was taken off the SAT. I'm looking for multiple choice at the bot. Wait here. A and B, not C.
Did you follow that?
I did follow that. Okay, so the woman says, hey, my husband's parents are throwing money into a college savings plan that my husband's daughter is using, and I'm concerned that my husband's ex-wife could use the money for something other than the intended purpose. And this is actually, and sadly, it's fairly common, both as a cause of stress and strife, and also something where sometimes people use money that is not in the intended purpose. We don't know that that's going on here. The best way to find out on where this money's going is seeing who actually owns the account. With 529 college savings plans, typically the owner is the parent or the grandparent or whomever is actually making the deposits, and then the child is the beneficiary. It's still the owner's money. Whoever is on the account as the owner, it still owns the money, even if there is a child on as the beneficiary. Any withdrawals that come out of the 529 plan, if the money is used for qualified higher education expenses, and there's a fairly liberal definition of what is a qualified higher education expense, then the money is tax-free. So it's kind of like a Roth IRA for college costs.
All right, so how does that withdrawal process work then?
It's not quite as black and white as many people might believe. The student incurs these qualified expenses during the year, and their expenses are paid for by someone. And then corresponding withdrawals can be made from the 529, and people who do own the account and do pull money from the 529 should document the withdrawals were taken out and matched with the expenses. And if you ever are audited by the IRS, you have to prove and say, well, here was the $10,000 that was taken out of the 529 plan, but here was at least $10,000 that was taken on in education expenses.
So if I'm following this correctly, it's the grandparents that are withdrawing the money and giving it to college students.
In theory, that was the way it should work. But sometimes the money might have been put in the ex-wife's name to control it. And especially if under the divorce decree, that can happen sometimes where they say, okay, we'll put the what they call a custodial parent in charge of this 529 account. And then that parent really has the right to pull the money out however they see fit.
But if the $10,000 withdrawal is spent on a new car or something,
sure,
that's not educational, not the education, then there's a problem.
There is a problem that's actually at least twofold. The first one is that the earnings from the account would be taxable, and there would be a small penalty on it to whomever took the money out of it. And second of all, it really defeats the purpose if the grandparents actually said, no, we only want this spent on college, and it's being spent someplace else. So the best way to do it is for whoever is making deposits in there to get receipts from the person actually paying for the expenses and then being reimbursed for it. And you can say it's just, you know, let's say it's the grandparents who own the account, and they say, hey, we need to see the expenses just for tax purposes, because if we get an audit, we want to show that there were corresponding tax purposes for the tax-free withdrawals from the qualified higher education account. And this is true, and so it's not a bluff. You just say, look, unless, you know, we can make sure that this money is going where we intended, we probably aren't going to make any deposits into the account in the future. And if there is some suspicion of it, then it actually ends up hurting the child who is a victim in all of this.
All right. Sounds good. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We will get to your questions in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, here to answer your personal finance questions if you have one, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Make that onyourmoney@wpr.org. And we get a lot of emails. We get a lot of calls for On Your Money, Kevin. We also, once in a while, get old-fashioned postcard. Mm. And we did get a postcard from a listener who wants to know, how can I legally gift money to family members and friends with no tax penalty? And does this have to be done only once a year?
Well, first of all, I think postcards should start ramping up the echelon of how we answer the questions. And they'll still be below ones that offer false praise to the show, but postcards get priority. You can give money to whomever you want. You have to file a gift tax return if you give more than $13,000 to someone who is not your spouse in a given year. And even then, you don't necessarily have to pay gift taxes on it, but the reason that they want to track the money, even if it's over the $13,000 but under the what they call the exempted amount, is people get a lifetime exemption amount that I think is right now is about $5 million that they can transfer to anyone they want to at any time, but they just have to file a gift tax return, not necessarily pay taxes on it. And the reason they do that is they want to prevent, you know, there's still an estate tax in place. It doesn't affect very many people, and it doesn't affect on assets generally under $5 million or estates under $5 million. But on amounts over that, they want to prevent against basically deathbed gifts where someone says, I'm about to die, I'm going to give all my money away so that the government doesn't tax it for it. So they do want to track it. It's $13,000 per year, and you, as long as you don't go over that amount, you don't have to file any paperwork. You don't have to document it in any way. You can give $13,000 in $100 bills if you want. And you can do that at several different periods. You can give $1,000 a month for 12 months if you'd like to do that. You don't have to do it all in one shot. It's only when you go over that amount. Let's say he were to give a grandchild $20,000. He would have to document the $7,000 excess over the $13,000 limit.
I see. Can he give me, for example, $13,000 and you, for example, $13,000?
Yes, he can. Mm-hmm. And the best time to do that is probably March 27th, which is our next membership drive, I believe.
No, actually, we are. We are going to be in a pledge drive starting Thursday of this week, and On Your Money next week will be in pledge drive mode. And we do, I know you, Kevin, are updating one of your famous mini money books.
The On Your Money mini book, 20 Money Moves. These are things, I went through this and I actually realized that, you know, when I do this as my grown-up job, I go more in-depth and personalize the advice. But this is really all the areas that we cover for people. And we charge a lot of money, and people are I'm happy to pay it. The check's always clear. But this will give you some for any dollar amount. It's a PDF file that you get emailed to you and right after you pledge, and it covers just about everything that you would have a question about, whether it's saving for retirement, paying off debt, paying for college, what to do with your mortgage, should you save in an IRA or a Roth IRA. All of these issues are covered in something that's fairly friendly and easy to read, and then there are links in most of the discussions that you can follow to get more information on as well. But any pledge at any dollar amount gets a copy of the mini money book, 20 Money Moves.
And just to conclude with our postcard writer, he will not receive a tax penalty for gifting money to family members or friends as long as he keeps it under $13,000.
Per person.
Per person.
Yep, so if he had 10 grandchildren, he could give each one of them $13,000, totaling $130,000 with no penalties, no forms, no nothing.
All right, I hope that helps. I know that particular writer has been trying to get that question answered for several weeks, mm-hmm. and I'm glad we're able to answer it. Sasha in Nina is with us. Hi, Sasha.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
For 2 months, I've been trying to catch you and my lucky day. Great show.
That's all the time we have, Sasha. Thanks for calling. Try again next week.
I figured you will say something like that.
He knows you too well.
He didn't say that in a complimentary tone either, did he?
Except the last week when you didn't show up. But at any rate, I work for a large telecommunications firm. I have a 401k. I'm 15 years into my career. I'm 35 years old. I can take a 401k loan out of up to $50,000 and at 4.25% interest over 5 years. And considering that it's not really making money, I thought, would that be a good idea for all my house improvements and driveway and et cetera?
I would use it as a last resort, not a first resort. Have you contacted, I assume you have a mortgage right now?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Have you contacted the original lender to say, hey, I'm thinking about doing some work. Can I either get a new mortgage or a new home equity line of credit or a new home equity loan?
They don't want to do it right now because they don't.
Okay.
It's not as easy as it sounds. And as far as the 401k loan, there's actually no fees, and all the interest goes right back to me.
Correct. That is technically correct. The problem is if you should lose your job either on your own choice or a choice made for you by your employer, that loan typically becomes immediately payable, and if you can't pay it back, then you have a taxable distribution and penalties. And the taxes and the penalties typically comprise about half the amount. And if you've already spent the loan amount on the home, you can't come up with the taxes and the penalties. So unless you have some other access to cash that you could use to either pay the loan off or at least pay the taxes and penalties, I'd be cautious about it. I wouldn't completely throw the idea out, but I wouldn't... It requires much more deliberation than just finding out the fees and which forms you have to complete, Sasha. And I'll tell you this. I would maybe go check with another lender or two and just see if someone else is a little more conducive to what you're trying to do.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
Sasha, thanks very much for the call. Bob in Franklin is with us now. Hello, Bob. Bob, what's new? Bob, I can't hear you. Bob must have hung up. So let's go to Jane.
Probably writing a postcard.
Yeah, that could be. Jane in Wauwatosa, are you there?
I am.
Good.
I am. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love listening to the show and always learn something. So
me too.
I'm happy to have the opportunity. The question that I have for Kevin is I recently went through a divorce. And I have a minor child who is 8 years old. I learned through some of the negotiations with my ex-husband that he has a custodial account for my son, and he's been less than forthcoming about disclosing his assets. What I've discovered is that he has used the account and to deposit larger sums of money in my son's account, but then has withdrawn the amounts, like within a year's time period. Well, it's large to me, probably around $25,000. Hmm. And my question is, first of all, what are the, Wisconsin must be under some regulations for uniform gift to minors or transfer to minors.
Mm-hmm.
And does that money not belong to my son?
No, it definitely belongs to your son under the terms that you've used to describe this. It's your son's social security number. It's his money. Anyone who is a custodian for an account like this set up under the UTMA or UGMA laws in some states is really just a trustee, and the account is almost like a trust. And then once the minor becomes a non-minor, a major, that money is his or hers. And investment and financial services firms used to be kind of lax about saying, oh, well, we know that, you know, this is really a 48-year-old minor, but you haven't gotten around to changing the designation. Well, they're getting a lot more diligent about making sure that accounts aren't transferred in like that.
Okay.
And it really has to, the laws of how that money can be used are, they aren't black and white. It has to be used really for the benefit of the child. And it has to, in the few times this has been tested in the courts, it's usually been for something above and beyond basic sustenance. You can't say, hey, this kid is eating me out of house and home, so I tapped his UTMA account. It has to be for something like, you know, private school tuition, braces, piano, computer, a car, and then, of course, college expenses on top of that. And I don't think that the legal penalties are probably much for that, but the tax penalties can be. And, you know, technically it is still your son's money. And so it's a good reason. It's a reason I don't, you know, for other listeners, I don't like these UTMA accounts generally anyway. If you're saving for college for a kid, 529 accounts are better. But, yeah, the money has to be used for the benefit of the child.
Jane, thank you very much for the call. If you have a question for Kevin, we now have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we will talk about prepaid debit cards. Are they a good idea or not? But right now, it's time for our next installment on our series on homeowners insurance. Last week we discussed why you may want to reevaluate your homeowners insurance policy. Today Kevin has some advice on how to make sure any future claims get paid to you. So that's an issue?
Yeah, you wouldn't think so looking outside today and say, what could ever go wrong in the weather that would cause some damage to my home? It's going to be 75 and sunny for the next 6 months. The policies are very confusing. Claims are definitely rising, and especially there's been some isolated pockets of severe weather around the country that have caused billions of dollars of claims to be made on homeowners insurance providers, and that means that by nature of insurance, some of the costs are spread out for the rest of the policyholders here. So you, and also the low interest rate environment that we talked about a few minutes ago is actually affecting the earnings of insurers, so they have to either charge more for premiums and tighten up their claims paying ability as well. So they're a lot of the problems with the homeowner's insurance is if you don't understand the policy and something happens, that's when you find out that you did not have coverage. So it's usually too late by the time that occurs.
So where should we start?
Go find the policy first, which can be hard enough for some people. Second of all, read it. Look for the exclusions and the declarations. That'll give you a more clear picture on what is actually covered and what is not covered. And if you want to go through and see what kind of coverage you actually need, there's a website called AccuCoverage.com that for about $8 you put in all of your information and it will tell you what kind of a policy you need, any riders you might have, the valuations for your home, etc. It's AccuCoverage.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website onyourmoney.com. Then make sure that your policy matches your situation for any other types of issues you have, like if you've had some redecorating going in, if you have some jewelry or some antiques or some artwork that's, you know, worth more than a few hundred dollars, you probably want to have some kind of rider on that. Contact the agent, say, I just want to go over the policy and make sure I understand it again. And then even after you get some time with the agent, call the company itself and say, I just want to verify this is what the agent told me. Is this still true? And most of all, write everything down during your conversations.
This is going to be convenient for me anyway. I just in the mail, I think, you know, within the last week got a reissue of my policy.
Yep.
So I can take
a good time to do it.
Yeah. So what should we do if something happens?
Well, first of all, think before you call. If it's something very small, and especially if it's something that's probably going to be either close to or below your deductible, you probably don't want to claim, because the more claims that you make on a homeowner's insurance policy, the more likely it is that the company may kick you off. And once you've been kicked off of a homeowner's insurance policy, it's very difficult to get back on again. And you even want to be careful about asking and just calling the company up and say, hey, you know, tree branch just fell through my window. There's been some water damage. Is this covered or not? If you think you might pay for it, you probably don't want to ask, because even if you don't make the claim, it may still go on your CLUE report, which is kind of the background of your home that we talked about last week. And if it goes on the CLUE report, it may affect your ability to get coverage in the future or to get it at an affordable rate. So what you want to do is say, you know, hypothetically, let's just say, my husband can't tell the difference between the gas and the brake, and plowed through the back of the garage. Would that be covered? And if so, what should I do to make sure that it gets paid appropriately?
And so assuming it is a covered event, then what?
Well, you want to prevent further damage, and especially water if it's from a storm or you think it might rain again. So get some tarps over it. Take pictures of all the damage. Contact the company as soon as possible. But if there is a lot of other damage within your area, don't be surprised if they can't get out there that very moment. Any discussions that you have with the company, get those in writing again, so you know, not only for your own reference, but down the road you can say, hey, you know, the adjuster told me this, and is it still true or not? And then watch out for signing for upfront money. Sometimes these companies will say, look, we're going to give you $1,000 right now so you can, you know, fix it, but you have to sign here saying you can't make any future claims on this particular incident. If you're okay with that, then sign it and get the money. But if not, say, you know what, I'm going to wait. You can always get the money down the road, and I'm going to have another person look at this.
So what if the claim, though, isn't resolved to your satisfaction?
Contact the agent and the company first and just say, you know what, I've got good reason to believe that I'm not getting paid for this as much as I should be under the terms of the policy. You can also contact the state insurance office, which can be very helpful for trying to help you sort through your options and getting some satisfaction. And finally, you may have to bring in a public adjuster who is almost like an arbitrator who will look at the situation and decide if your claim has merit or so. And you can go to NAPIA to find a public adjuster. And again, we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, did I ever tell you, Kevin, I think it was a few years ago anyway, when there was a tornado in Madison, and my backyard was affected. A big maple tree, a big limb was blown off, and it fell on my neighbor's garage.
What's the problem?
Well, I was on vacation for one when it happened. I came home to this the very next day. But it wasn't, it was my understanding, I don't remember all the ins and outs. My brain is foggy on the details. But it was as though homeowners insurance really didn't cover that kind of a, you know, limb falling down on. And indeed, it might have been my neighbor's problem, not my problem.
That's highly possible.
Yeah.
And it's a case, too, of there are a lot of things that homeowners insurance actually does cover, which you wouldn't think they do.
Yeah.
There are some identity theft issues that can be covered, so that's why it's a good reason to see what your options are and to reevaluate your policy before the branch actually falls.
Yeah, and I actually ended up just paying for its removal, and I didn't even think I would try to submit any kind of claim, because I figured it really wasn't worth
it. If it's under $500 to $1,000, yeah, you're usually just going to end up writing a check anyway.
If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our next caller is Bob in Blue Mounds. Hello, Bob.
Yeah, I want to give Kevin a chance to reiterate his wisdom on refinancing.
That's what I'm doing. I'm not droning on. I'm not repeating it over again. I'm reiterating. Thank you very much.
Reiterating wisdom.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 15-year versus 30-year, so I know you're probably going to say 30-year, but I'm going to turn 59 this year. My wife's 54. We're trying to decide, but good interest rates on, you know, below 4% on both a on a potential refi for 30-year and 15. So why don't you have a go at that?
How much time do we have?
Yeah.
Thanks, Bob. The you can take a 30-year out and make the payment required of the 15-year? Because the payment, even with the lower interest rate, the payment on the 15-year is probably a little bit more than the 30-year, correct?
It's somewhere like, $1,200 or $1,300 a month versus $1,700.
Yep. Okay. Those fairly significant dollar amounts tilt me even more towards the notion of the 30-year, because if you feel like paying the mortgage off and you take the 30-year out, you can always accelerate your payments. And if you make that $1,700 payment on the 30-year mortgage, you will still pay the mortgage off within about 15 and a half years, maybe 16. But if anything comes up in the future, Bob, and especially since are you retired or just nearing
retirement? No, we probably both have at least 10 years of work ahead.
Okay, even more so then. If anything happens in your life from a personal basis, or if something happens economically, maybe interest rates go up to 6 or 7%, and you can slow down that payment process, you'll be very glad that you have it. If there were, let's say a 20% penalty to pay off a mortgage early, I'd say, why don't you just take the 15-year and get that over with. But there's no penalty to do that whatsoever. So I'd much rather have you maintain the higher cash flow and the lower more flexibility from the 30-year mortgage. And especially when you're making this transition, if you said, no, I'm going to be working for the next 20 years or I'm going to be, I actually am retired already. I think I'm just going to pay this off and I have lots of money left over. I might look at the 15-year, but making this transition from working full-time to retiring can be very stressful, both from your own standpoint and from your job security and for incurring health expenses. So I'd much rather have you the freedom to stay in your house with a lower payment and get the 30-year instead.
Okay. Can I ask a related question? What is your standard cushion that you should have in the bank and savings types of accounts before you start paying off? We have one student loan paying at about 6%.
Mm-hmm. If for working people, I'd like to have at least a year's worth of living expenses. That's about how long people are unemployed on average now. And then for retired people, I'd like you to have probably 150 to 200 times your net monthly expenses built up in savings. And net means your cost of living for a typical month, and subtract out Social Security and pension payments. Take the remaining amount, multiply it by 150 to 200. Once you get that in savings, if you can't figure out anything else to do with your money, then maybe you can just pay down the mortgage.
Good luck to you, Bob. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, is a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. He'll answer more of your questions in just a moment, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. And Kevin, prepaid debit cards are becoming a pretty widely used alternative to more traditional payment methods. But you are a little bit concerned about the. You don't think that the benefits are worth the cost?
Well, these are kind of like a gift card that can be used almost anywhere that a debit or credit card could be used. And one analyst group says that it could be $150 billion market this year, and that's about $1,300 per American household. The major providers are, American Express, some of the other bank cards, but also Walmart, and there's a company called Green Dot that offers these as well. And what happens is you buy the gift card, or the debit card, rather, with a store of cash in it, and then you can recharge it periodically if you want. And the way most people use this is instead of a checking account or a debit card.
Well, so who's using these?
It's usually people who either don't want to carry cash or use checks or can get a credit card or a debit card. It's really the unbanked, if you will. And the FDIC says that about 1 out of 10 American households are unbanked. They either don't have a living situation that allows them, to get mail or a permanent address, or they have a really shoddy credit history, so they can't even get a checking account or a debit card. And maybe the fees on their institution are so high that they're okay with using this prepaid debit card instead. But sometimes the fees on these can really take advantage of the users.
Well, yeah, so How so? How do the fees take advantage of the users?
Almost all of them have a monthly fee that might be $3 to $5 to $10. There's a, might be a fee to buy it in about that amount. There's another fee to recharge these. Let's say you get one for $100. You spend the $100. You want to put more money back onto it. There might be a $5 charge to recharge it. If you call to say, hey, I've got this card and I want to know how much is left on it, that might incur a fee. And if you lose it and replace it, that might incur a fee as well. And, you know, the fees are bad enough, but these are people who, you know, $3 to $5 for many people is an annoyance. For these people, it's serious money. And so tacking on more fees can be a big problem for them. And we, to make it even more interesting, there are several celebrity endorsers who have sponsored these kinds of prepaid debit cards to try to pull people in.
Who's doing that?
Well, a young, enterprising young woman by the name of Kim Kardashian had a card that was geared towards teens, and it was just terrible for fees. It was one of the worst ones out there. And so she actually, in a rare moment of lucidity, canceled that plan and offered it. But still, rapper Lil Wayne, hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons, and the woman who has proclaimed herself to be the personal finance expert to the world, Susie Orman, has her own prepaid debit card that she has put up. And it has $3 per month fees and allegedly has some benefits like credit monitoring or some identity protection. She's marketing this. She used to be a big opponent of these kinds of cards. Now she's marketing it by saying, we're trying to convince the credit bureaus to monitor prepaid debit card use so that you, they can see that you use this responsibly and it will hopefully build up your credit rating. But so far that's just a pie in the sky wish on her part. They don't monitor these and they typically don't pay much attention to because you're just spending, you know, you're spending your own money for it. I think it's an interesting idea, and we're actually going to do one of these for On Your Money.
No, we're not.
yes, we are, because it's an alternative. And what we'll do for listeners, if you send us $21, we will send you the On Your Money prepaid paper. And it's a piece of paper about 6 inches long and about 2 inches high. And it's anonymous. You can use it anywhere you want with just about any, no fees or whatsoever on it. And it has a picture of Andrew Jackson on the front of it. So I think we're going to start marketing that. I just have to get it approved by legal, run
if,
it by them.
If you send us $21. Yeah. Well, I'm kind of disappointed in Susie for doing that. That's
typically something that... It kind of went against the grain for a lot of things that she's been a proponent of in the past.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm just kind of wrapping this up a little bit more. I guess you say avoid them. Avoid those prepaid debit cards. And
if you can. And I understand why people either can't get at them or, you know, when a lot of people get mad about these fees, well, check your bank or credit union because many of them are trying to put these same kinds of fees on your checking account and your debit account and your credit card account. So it's a case of because, again, the low interest rate environment, most financial institutions can't make money the way they did in the old days. So they're looking for new sources of income. This is one place that they're trying to make some more money.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. We have time for more of your questions now. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Well, Bob in Franklin is back. Hi, Bob. Are you there this time?
Yeah, I was using my headphones. They didn't work.
Oh. Well, I'm glad that we have you now.
Yeah, I'd like to know if a non-working spouse can make a contribution to an IRA, and if so, are there income limits, or how does that work?
The non-working spouse can make contributions to an IRA and to a Roth IRA as long as the working spouse has earned income that equals the amount of the contributions, meaning that, let's say, you're the one working, Bob, and your wife is staying at home, and you make $12,000, well, then the two of you can each make $6,000 contributions to an IRA or a Roth IRA as long as you're over 50 years old. It's $5,000 if you're under 50. The place where it gets kind of sticky is if you are also contributing to an at-work plan, like a 401k or 403b or 457 plan, then your income restrictions are pretty severe It's about $50,000. So is if you can make a tax-deductible IRA, you can still make a Roth IRA contribution as long as your adjusted gross income is less than about $160,000 to $170,000 for the two of you. You can make Roth IRA contributions not only for yourself, but also for the non-working spouse, if you will, and vice versa if you are the non-working spouse.
Makes sense, Bob?
Well, she is contributing to an at-work IRA.
Okay.
So that limit would be $50,000?
It's $57,000, but again, it depends on the actual type of plan at work. Is it like a 401k, or is it a simple IRA, or do you know what it is?
I think it's a 401k.
Okay. Then, yeah, and truth be told, Bob, I would almost rather have you do Roth IRAs anyway, because if you're under or close to that limit, of the income limit, your taxable income right now is going to be relatively low. You might be better off just using the Roth IRA anyway, but you can check at irs.gov, and I think we've got a link to a calculator as well at onyourmoney.com that can tell you which one you qualify for, and if not, I'll try to put that up on the site later on today.
All right, thanks, Bob, for the call. Good luck. Steve in Wausau is with us next. Hello, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask Kevin about a strategy I heard, and I think I've seen it in print a few times, of buying whole life insurance, building up some cash value, and then when you get to be 70 and a half or 80 years old, you start borrowing the cash value out with the intentions of never paying it back and just take a reduction in the life benefit of the policy for your heirs. Is that still a viable strategy?
If it ever was, and it could have been, I don't think it is right now. I and especially in a very low interest rate environment. And, you know, life insurance is not a bad investment to hang on to, especially if you've had one of these whole life policies for more than 20 years. That's typically the break-even point where it makes sense to hang on to it. And many of these life insurance companies are still paying somewhere between 3% and 5% interest on their whole life policies. But in terms of a new strategy, I would much rather have you just buy life insurance because you need life insurance either for liquidity in a business or for estate tax purposes, rather than saying that you want to do this because it's a smart strategy to do it. What happens is, and again, especially in a low rate environment, which I think we'll be in for quite some time, the cost of running the insurance company eat up most, or the insurance policy rather, and managing the money eat up most of the returns. So you won't make very much money on it. You'll just have your premiums in and not much else. I'd like to be pleasantly surprised by that, but I'll assume that things are going to be pretty slow for the next several decades. Therefore, buy life insurance because you need to provide for somebody else, and then invest the money yourself.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Another life insurance related question from Matt in Lafarge. Hi, Matt. I'm sorry, it's Pat. Go ahead.
Pat, yeah. Yeah, they had a recent pledge drive on Wisconsin Public TV, and there was a guy on there, one of the talk advisors, a guy named Ed Slott. And he was kind of poo-pooing any kind of investment in investing in stocks or bonds, at least at this point in time. And he was going, his things he was pushing were Roth IRA, which I understand. I think that's generally, although it does have some drawbacks, which you didn't discuss at all. But the other two items that he was pushing, which I highly question, would be a whole life insurance policy and immediate and annuities, mm-hmm. I believe. Mm-hmm. Both, because you could presumably get money out of them right away and they would be guaranteed. And I just wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I'm a little disappointed to find out that anyone would listen to any other financial guy. I mean, you only have to put in 1 hour a week, people, to listen to the show.
I was trying to help out Wisconsin Public TV.
I'm okay. All for that, okay. Then. All okay. Right, I appreciate that. I'm not a big fan of either one of the... I like Ed Slott. I've talked to him before in the past, and I like the way that he presents his advice. I'm not a huge fan of cash value life insurance as a retirement strategy, nor am I a fan of immediate annuities, especially right now, and again, especially because of a low interest rate environment. Yes, it's guaranteed, but the guarantee is only as good on an immediate annuity as the solvency of the insurance company remains in place, meaning they can pay you back. And what you're doing is you're giving the money to an insurance company saying, you promised to invest this and pay me back. And they say, you bet. you could bury the money in the hole in the ground in many places, in many cases, and find out that your return of just pulling the dollars out every single month is almost as good as the immediate annuity, and you can always pull the rest of the money out of the hole in the ground whenever you want to, versus with the immediate annuity, you've lost control over it, and all you're going to get are these payments back. Especially in retirement, because many people have a pension of some sort, which is an immediate annuity, and they have Social Security, which is an immediate annuity. So you're already kind of subject to that. Your bigger issue is probably going to be covering unanticipated expenses, and immediate annuities do not do a very good job of helping you out in an emergency. So I don't think those are the worst things in the world for some people. I just don't think that they should be as used as widely as some people might say.
Pat, thanks for the call, and thanks for helping out our friends at Wisconsin Public Television. Amy in New London is with us next. Hello, Amy.
Hi. My question is a little different slant. I always have had an interest in financial planning, and I was wondering if I wanted to pursue a career to become a financial planner, what steps you would recommend.
There are no openings. It's all closed. It's done. It's too hard of a job. You don't sound bright
Never
enough
mind,
to do it.
Amy.
Very, very tight market.
Yes,
tight market.
Yep, sorry. I wish I could help you. No, actually, I've done this for 24 years. I love it. It's really a great job. I'm amazed at the number of people who go to law school, for instance, and really aren't passionate about being attorneys or studying the law. Those people should be becoming financial planners, certified financial planners instead, because it's a very similar job without the headache, without the hassle, without the required law school bills, et cetera. So are you asking how do you get into the field?
Yes, and I guess, if possible, avoiding some of the big franchise type operations,
sure,
where I'm sure you could learn, but you know they're pushing their own products and not necessarily the benefit of the clients.
You generally have to be associated with a firm to become a certified financial planner. After that, you can go out on your own, and you can. I mean, I'm my own boss, if you will, and. Then you can be a certified financial planner. It's typically, you bill by the hour when you're preparing financial plans and recommendations for people. If you go to cfp.net, that's the organization that talks about some of the regulation to become a certified financial planner. But it's possible to be a financial planner without being certified. You generally have to be licensed by the states in which you do business. And that can be an issue for people who have no experience. But it's actually a good idea to try to get on with a firm or some kind of firm just so you can see what the job is like and see if they have a training program, because sometimes you'll not only learn everything you know, but they might pay you to learn as well.
Okay. And do you recommend going to a bank versus some of the franchise type?
I'd recommend getting a job where you can get a job where the culture fits with what you're looking to do. The franchise ones aren't terrible, but I'd a bank or even an investment firm or an insurance firm is a good start to figure out what actually is involved in being some type of financial advisor.
And good luck to you, Amy. We have time for the website of the week now, Kevin.
KnowYourStuff.org is a free site from the Insurance Institute. You can put in all of your home items that are covered under homeowners insurance, and they not only print it out on paper, but you can store it online, and there's an iPhone app for it, knowyourstuff.org, and we'll have a link to that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And what is coming up next week for the Pledge Drive edition of On Your Money?
20 Money Moves. Pledgers at any level get a free copy of this. It will answer many of the questions that you have and can't get through or don't have time to answer or don't want to ask in front of several thousand listeners. 20 Money Moves, the On Your Money mini money book to pledgers at every level.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And we will talk again next week for another edition of On Your Money. Tomorrow at this time, understanding how habits shape our lives and how we can shape our habits. We'll be talking with the author of The Power of Habit tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing the program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.